Thank you all for the this poem that has no title, but it was wrote at the start of the moment about a month or two ago. And the first time being allowed to a home, people thought, excuse me if I get too nervous. When the world fell, we all stood back, shocked as it had been so sudden and cool, with no warning. But, looking back, don't we all know that we, it was us who chose to ignore the warning signs, that it was us who were so scared of impending change that we hid our heads in the sand. Now it's not time to play victim.
Thank you, Susan. And next we have Carl Holden.
Hey, how are you guys doing? So I was going to do something a bit different. It's going to try to freestyle. I had a couple of points, so I'm kind of rethinking. So I'm going to do a piece called Fighting the Man, right? All my life I'd wanted to fight the man. The trouble was, I could never find him. I asked my friends and family, neighbours and strangers, but all I got was laughter, abuse, and the occasional false address. I changed my tactics. I made a sandwich board that said, "Have you seen the man?" I stood on prominent street corners in the central business district of major cities. All I found were people who seemed to know where Jesus was. I didn't want to fight Jesus. I wanted to fight the man. I wrote letters in the post. 12 noon by the old clock tower, no shooters. The postman didn't know where the man was either. I sent letters to celebrities, presidents, prime ministers, and the ambassadors of 72 countries. "Dear sir or madam, have you seen the man?" All I got was a personalized response from a famous hip-hop artist's secretary that said, "You the man." I thought about this all for a little while, and then I realized I didn't want to fight myself. I wanted to fight the man. I stooped as low as manfinder.com. I went on the radio. I asked the nation, and all I got was a 20-minute segment on national television called "Looking for the Man." A journalist showed up at my doorstep. I started receiving fan mail. Good luck finding the man, and give him one from me. Let me just think of the next bit. People started putting up posters. I found air travel tickets in my letterbox. I went on tour to the Isle of Man, the Sultanate of Oman, and Suriname, because it's in there backwards. I made inspirational speeches, talked to audiences of thousands, and opened a rock concert with a little number called "Looking for the Man." I went on Oprah, talked to Dr. Phil, autographed knuckle dusters, breasts, and small animals. I was beginning to enjoy myself. I bought a small island in the Bahamas, the proceeds of my autobiography, Manhunter. I married a local girl, had two more on the side, and bought a yacht when the book became a movie. I founded a small private bank. I dealt exclusively with deposits of presidents, prime ministers, and the ambassadors of 6 countries' solid financial system. I invested wisely. I fired my crooked accountant the week before his arrest. Founded a small private bank. I'm sorry, I must take your order a little bit there. I bought a bigger yacht, an airline, and an oil field. I had my face on billboards from Manhattan to Mandalay. I was Time Magazine's Man of the Year. I was Forbes Magazine's Man of the Year. I was National Geographic's Man of the Century. I was the fucking man. I will try to freestyle. I heard about this thing, it's called Film Flop Ireland. I've been looking at it, it's rap battles, and it's sort of very aggro and very offensive. So I'll try to tone that down, but I warn you I will swear, because I have no idea to consider it, because it's gas. So I guess I will start with a description of what rap battling is. Can I get a word, actually? Somebody.
A word.
A word.
Clown.
clown. All right, okay, so... motherfucker, he's the motherfucking clown. You're like one of Mrs. Brown's boys playing with toys in the fucking bathroom. Well, I've been whacking it up like I'm on mushrooms. I've been in another fucking dimension. I'm whacking it out like running out of time, and I'll be changing and finding a new direction and crossing more lines, the Pacific Midwestern. I don't know if that's a real train, it's just coming out of my brain, see? And I'll be walking up like Bajra Yogini. I'm taking this in a direction that's more Buddhist-y, see? I'm going to slow down the pace, so I don't go to space. So, let's get back to this. So I'm a Taoist. That's from the same country as Maoist, China. But I'm finer than Maoist, this is Taoist. This is about the Tao, the Mao, the here. And what's here is... the sphere of activity that we live in that rapid sea, because this is what's happening and this is what I be. I be doing this truly, and that might be false pride, but this is false modesty, because rapping is about trying to express honesty, and that's really fucking hard. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And next we have Emily David Fletcher.
I wrote this kind of advice to like my inner child and the child that I was, so it's just in development. It's probably going to end up being like 10 pages, but just very short right now. Dear child, be patient with your mother. She was not born your mother. She was once younger than you and prettier. There are pictures to prove it. Don't take revenge by talking bad about her to her mother, your grandma. Don't tell grandma about the sink full of dishes, the empty fridge, and how the cat has to share the dog's food. Grandma did not sit her in a magnolia tree and rock her dollies. She did not scratch her arms and legs. She did not gently scratch her arms and legs with long pink nails, creating warm waves under her skin when asked. Grandma scribbled iodine on the backs of her baby pictures, lost her twice at the store, left her in the sand to play, with the dog licking, the piss leaking down from her puppy thighs. Taught her to ice skate and lied to her father about who they had been with all day. Don't cry about your birthday money she has borrowed for good, spent on cigarettes, a six-pack, while you wait in the car worrying she won't come back, and stare into the yellow light for her face, while the door willing the doors to yawn her back to you. Somehow you miss her and she surprises you when she comes back with cheap candies and teases you with a riddle you must solve before you get it. Child, don't worry about your mother all your life. You are her happiest accident, and she did not doubt you once. Don't scream at her because she lost your baby teeth that she kept in a silver cup. You don't remember her real teeth or the last time she slept in her bed. Stop making her bed for her birthday and making her promise to sleep in it. She wants to stay up as late as possible. She wants to fall asleep on the sofa between two doors with the TV light as a blanket. Child, you are a deluded version of your mother and can do no better, no worse.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you. And now we have Bill Sweeney.
This is the introduction to, you know, the letters of maybe going up. She's a school teacher in a very tough inner city school anyway, and this is the introduction to the book, if you like. It's called A Little Warning Note from Maeve. I came to St. Cecilia High after finishing my HDE, the third level teaching diploma, commonly known as HDIP. Don't be deceived by this nonchalant abbreviation. The course involving teaching practice is far more than just a dip, more like a full immersion, drowning even. My vague tutor, George Rysom, at the University of Dublin Department of Education, suggested that it might be a good idea to keep a journal during my first year in the classroom. Rysom was just one of Professor Dunhill's lackeys. Professor Dunhill was head of the educational department, and he was a legend. Never seen, never heard, but everyone terrified of him. The Winsome Rice recommended that aspiring young teachers keep a daily journal, a useful exercise in professional self-scrutiny, he declared. Ryson's glasses tended to dribble down his nose as he spoke, and we used to gaze fascinatedly at him, trying to predict the exact moment he would intervene to prevent them slipping off. A way of monitoring one's progress, Ryson would drone on as we watched him praying that his spectacles would fall just once. The elusive Professor Dunhill, known to us students as Professor Dunhill, was big into progress and aims and objectives, but after a few months teaching in St. Cecilia High, the only kind of progress I was thinking of was the kind I could make out the gate with one career objective in mind, never to return. The supervisor who did Dunhill's bidding like a lapdog insisted on lesson plans before each class. These were to indicate the material to be covered and the methods used, and then afterwards he wanted us to write accounts of how the class had gone. I didn't mind this. The idea of keeping records appealed to me. You never knew. They might come in handy in a legal sense, in the event of claims, or might contain vital clues to help the police in their efforts to recover my body. In any case, I have always had a penchant for writing. Ever since I was a child, I've kept records. Mammy is now in the kitchen washing the dishes. Jimmy is upstairs setting a pillow on fire. I can smell the smoke. I wonder when the fire brigade are going to come. I wrote down everything that happened from the first day I could write. I kept so many records, I must have broken some. I probably should have been in the Guinness book, but my father never approved of drink. For months as a teenager, I wasn't speaking to either of my parents and used to communicate with them from my bedroom by means of slips of paper under the door. It worked well until I received a note one evening. It was brief. Start talking again or it's counseling. The bullies forced me to give up my written communications, but my love for the written word has remained undiminished, and so it was. On entering for the first time in St. Cecilia High, I soon found that I much preferred writing to talking. I began, therefore, scribbling endlessly on the blackboard. I felt no desire to speak with the teenage inhabitants of the jungle before me. Behind me, in fact, which was far worse. I only verbally remonstrated with my young charges when I heard noises that could no longer reasonably be ignored. Interventions such as, "Come down from that lampshade, Jason," or, "I thought I told you not to be sharpening that knife in class, Patrick," were of limited help, and only for brief intervals. Verbal admonitions such as, "Don't you think it's time you took your hands from around Jason's neck, Thomas?" made little impression in St. Cecilia's. Admonitions were no good. What you needed was ammunition. Writing, in effect, was a kind of buffer for me, armour against the slings and arrows of outrageous misfortune that prevailed in St. Cecilia High. Words made me feel safe, helped me remain in my world and keep the madding crowds at bay. When I could no longer fit any more writing on the board, I would invite my pupils to take down what I had written. This gave me an opportunity to write in my journal. This is something I would do every day, describing in detail what was going on in the classroom. I felt like an explorer deep in the rainforest, anxious to document the extraordinary species and forms of behavior that surrounded me. I think he meant me to write in the staff room during free periods, or at night time. Unfortunately, I was out cold by the time night time came. At any rate, he did not intend, I realize now, that I actually write during the classes. He obviously assumed I would be teaching then. He didn't know St. Cecilia's. Now I ask you to imagine, dear reader, the following situation. You are in a jungle. You are confronted by a tribe of baboons. Would you reason with them? Would you take out your violin and start playing in the hope of improving their temperament, civilizing them? Would you request that they sit down and take out their books? I rest my case. I rest my case.
Thank you, Joel, and the case rest. Next we have the music by Dear Justice.
This is a song by Joanna Newton. Hey, 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 the end is near. On a good day you can see the end from here. But I won't turn back now, though the way is clear. I will stay for the remainder. I saw the light and I called it mine. I saw it drawn so sweet and fine. And I had begun to fill in all the lines, right down to what we'd name her. Our nature does not change by will. In the winter by the ruined mill, oh, the creek is lying flat and still. It is water though it's frozen. Across the years and miles and through, on a good day you can feel my love for you. Will you leave me be so that we can stay true to the path that you have chosen? Thank you.
Thank you, dear. That was lovely. And next we have Mary O'Connell.
This is called Kelly Live. Politics consists in choosing between the disastrous and the unpalatable. J.K. Galbraith. The poor endure more savage cuts, while bankers go scot-free. We're gnawed, bludgeoned, beggared to improve our GDP. Despite the change in government, things still look pretty bleak, with promises forgotten from Enda's winning streak. When Kenny swore he'd never close Roscommon's A&E, his words came back to haunt him, and one Fianna Gael TV, Dennis Nocton, lost the whip for trying to make a stand. What's the point of a new government that hasn't changed the brand? Enda had a habit of doing things on the spot. 3 years ago, he cut his pay, though not by a whole lot. 5% was what he hoped would prove that he was fair. His colleagues were dismayed by the new burden they would share. Abolishing the Seanad was another of his aims. Again, his party colleagues saw the whole thing as a hames. A lot of them saw Enda as inept, lightweight, and mild. The Gang of Nine were happy to treat him like a child. In 2010, they hatched a plot to oust him as their boss. This full frontal lobotomy would prove to be their loss. If Oxbridge tutored Bruton were to ask him to resign, the whole putsch could be glossed over and save a lot of time. But Mayo men are tough as nails. The rebels got it wrong. Enda had their measure. He'd been ready all along. He'd fluffed his lines on water tax. He'd wobbled on Sinn Féin, and when George Lee deserted him, he really felt the pain. but Kenny's been in politics for 35 long years. He'd watched five heaves on hockey and faced up to his fears. So when the young Turks gathered with their golden credit cards, sipping cappuccinos with their sights on top awards, they were sure they'd make a killing. Klongos against the tech. But the lads who munched hang sandwiches decided, what the heck? We'll always have our dinner in the middle of the day. Shout up, Mayo, and make damn sure that Inga has his say. Since then, he's lashed the Vatican, refusing to be cowed. He copied White House speeches and uttered some aloud. But the honeymoon is over. While Obama and the Queen made the early days a doddle, those triumphs have lost their sheen. Tensions keep arising between Fine Gael and Labour, despite their leaders aiming for exemplary behaviour. Complete cooperation is what they'd like to show, but if Enda lays down what to do, they tell him where to go. Only time will tell if he can make this country work again. Emigration and the euro make it hard to figure when.
Thank you, Mary, for this very sad resume of the past few years. Moving on, Patricia Walsh.
And it's called Sleeping with Ghosts. They called it an archaeological field trip, but I know better. Dodging a broken, nerdy stone, sculptures of stone and intermittent bone. Are these bones any more beautiful now? The queen of everything is a handful of sorrow, though human flesh is too salty for some, as is etched on crypts that show off their wares at a correct angle of sunlight. Stacked collective faith, no name, recognizable but collective, rotted mouth and lichen, their names of their attenuation to an archaeologist's delight. This is called the Alabaster Saint. Permanence once was the way to go. Etched in alabaster to forever smile, to attend the glory over a god, or a constant shuffle of mortals as did in later times. Yet Aristotle, indifferent, has seen and not remembered. The slaves of time only ate, such as we. Some denies, extra scripts, births, deaths, marriages, on your attempts at longevity, I don't think smartly seen it all. You could do with a reformation yourself, of time to strip you of guilt, colour, pigment, spare blushes, grandeur, laugh with indifference at your creator, hammering and choosing at your future. But mark my words, you will never outlive me. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. Next we have Simon Deasy, followed by Simon Deasy.
It's a tiny bit of prose. It's called The Cage. There were set shifts that we were assigned in rotation. The earliest began at 7 a.m. and the latest ended at 9 p.m. And for the most part, they fell evenly and you would get as many of one as you would the other. The mornings were maniacal. The building would squirm like a person who believes there to be ants somewhere beneath their clothes. And the people who burned with ambition, the people who could pretend that they did, would zip past people like me and a handful of others who would drift around, clearly suffering from the kind of hangover that often made the man-sized plant that rose over the front reception desk look comfortable and inviting, like a leafy bed or bosom. And so, I always preferred the late shifts for the quiet alone. Within each 8-hour shift, you were given an hour off that was broken into three breaks, 2 15 minutes long and 1:30. And when lucky enough to have a week or two of the lates to get through, my routine would be to eat for my 30-minute break and to save the other two smaller breaks for the evening, for when I would take them both within the same hour. And even though sometimes the team whose job it was to monitor adherence to the break schedule would notice and notify a team lead, I knew that none of them would ever know my reason, that only I would ever know that I did it all due to the comfort of the cage. The cage was 10 feet high and green, and it joined to one end of the building, and the only way in or out of it was through the heavy glass door that led into it, as the fencing itself was whole. The door was always locked, like every other door in the building, but for a 4-second window after any of the personalized security badges that we'd all been given passed over any of the swipe boxes that were on the wall to the right of every door. The cage was a good place to smoke at any time, free of any impulses to run, but in the evening, after dusk, it was serene. I'd swipe my card and push through the heavy glass door that would clunk closed behind me, while a sensor would detect my presence, and a light would click on, and I'd stand there, mostly alone, but for the city's distant white and auburn lights, and any insects trying to get in out of the night.
Thank you, Colin. And I think we've lost our musician, okay, we'll go to Dr. Rab.
These small things render affection lasting. Race you to the top of the church steps, I said. A glanced exchange and off you sped, tearing after you at high speed. Glorified by the way you moved, I gained the top step. That was a draw, I suspect. A draw? Drawn to you, drawing pictures of me and you. On we went to the next, to me, significant event, which after your cousins was Animax Pop for the crack, and the crippled old man who told us that he'd had great loss too, referencing me and you, Sun King and Moon Queen, enveloped in gold and blue, and he knew the affection between us was so palpable as to be almost visible, and he saw it. And he recognised it, and he had felt the loss of it, and that came through in the manner with which he approached us. Thank you.
Thank you, next, we have our final reader for tonight, Julie Field. Can I
just
time?
Go ahead, sure.
Yeah, sure.
Short story, really short. State of emergency. The two young lesbians nodded in agreement to one another before escaping through the emergency doors of the nightclub. They'd anticipated that a squealing alarm would be activated, but all that could be heard as they burst out onto the dribbling alleyway with their screams of laughter. They ran and skipped as fast as they could away from the venue, relishing the safe and dramatic exit, whilst cackling, "It's an emergency." They rushed into the arms of an octopus city floating on adrenaline. Both young ladies had travelled far and wide to the city which hosted the country's largest gay clubs. It was never imagined that the night would take the bizarre twist that it had. The club of choice had come highly recommended by a stranger they'd met in the gay bar earlier that night. In hindsight, he was a bit unusual. In hindsight, his hands shook profusely and it was hard to distinguish whether he was dancing or twitching whilst recommending the club to them. Alien to the urban epicentre, the newly born ladylikers accepted this man's word and strutted into the club with high expectation. The bar was dotted with luminous special offer songs. A sea of fit, well-dressed men danced gaily to the house music which rattled the air. The club was cave-like, with low ceilings and unsuspecting corners. The lack of women proved an instant cause for concern for the two lesbians. They were hoping to dance and flirt with smiling ladies. Having bopped around the upper floor, it was decided they'd go down a level in search of the tropical mass of lesbians which they'd been promised. They came across the Covenant Vixens in a damply lit corner of the club. A bodybuilt bouncer stood to attention in front of the emergency exit and overlooked the action. Sitting at a high table and sipping blue drinks, the two lesbian cubs surveyed the talent. It was clear that all of the women knew one another. It was clear they were part of a tribe. They watched as the women laughed, danced, and played with one another. The newcomers too were eyeballed, and one drunk woman gestured to them to join in. Both cubs refused graciously, however, and whispered to each other that there was something intimidating about the way the woman had spoke. Letting themselves get lost in the music for a while, and letting the mysterious blue drink soak up some inhibition, the two newcomers danced near their table. Just moments after the security joined walked past them and disappeared among the waves of male dancers, two women lunged at each other from opposite sides of the cave. The newcomers stopped dancing and took a step back from the scuffle just feet before them. Everybody seemed to watch the women roll around the floor for a few seconds, and suddenly, as if choreographed, many others joined in. They kicked and punched and jumped and roared. Both young cubs looked at each other with a holy shit expression. The scene of flying fists, elbows and high heels was first after just a few minutes. There was no sign of the security guard. All of the women seemed to be joking and laughing in two different groups, and nobody appeared physically hurt. Just as the atmosphere was breathing a sigh of relief, the violent chaos erupted once more, like a nasty fart bellowing from the bowels of the club. A tall, thin woman, who appeared to be the ringleader, reached to grab someone on the opposing team. Her friend tried to pull her back, but only managed to grab hold of her ponytail. One of the cubs squealed in horror as she noticed the singer's friend had detached her ponytail from her head. She breathed a sigh of relief as she saw the thin girl return to her friend and reattach her fake ponytail. Within a second of fixing her hair, the thin girl leapt on the pack of fighting women like a feral cat. It seemed much more serious and vicious this time, and both young cubs stepped back and gave each other a panicked look. They saw the glasses were being picked up and aimed at head. They didn't want to hang around to see the damage done. They were pressed against a corner and scared in the knowledge there was no escape. One cub grabbed the other and they ran towards the emergency door. They cackled their way to their hotel room. The adrenaline which pumped through their veins numbed the burning sensation from their stilettos. Even after the lights were dimmed and both cubs were tucked up in bed, lyrical giggles would splutter from beneath the cover. They vowed to venture out to a different club the following evening.